I call the meeting of the House Water Division to order. A quorum is present. The first item on the agenda is approval of minutes. Representative Claflin, would you like to move approval of the minutes?
I move approval of minutes.
Representative Claflin moves approval of the minutes for February 4th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion is the minutes are approved from February 4th. The first item that we have on our agenda today is House File 408, Representative Poppy. If I could have Representative Poppy come down. Members, we have House File 408 up for consideration today. It was referred to us by the Environmental Finance Division. And as Chair, I'll move House File 408 to be referred to the Environmental Finance Division. Representative Poppy, thank you for being here today. Please present your bill and introduce your testifiers.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm very pleased today to have people from the Cedar River Watershed District here with me, and they'll be able to introduce themselves a little bit more in detail, but I will say Justin Hansen and Cody Fox are both here, and they're going to present about the Cedar River Watershed District and what they are doing to reduce flooding and improve water quality within the district. They also happen to be involved with the Maurer County Soil and Water Conservation District, and so they have a lot of background in understanding how to work with farmers and landowners and people that are impacted by flooding. And in my area of the state, which is in southern Minnesota, we do have some water that flows through the city of Austin and flows around the district. So I'm going to let them actually explain a little bit about what they're doing, what they have done, how it's been working, and to make sure that we can give you a full flavor of what is happening within my district. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Poppy. And first off, if you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and then start your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Hansen. As Representative Poppy mentioned, I work as administrator for the Cedar River Watershed District and also district manager for the Soil and Water Conservation District in Austin, so south central Minnesota, southeast Minnesota. With me is Cody Fox. He's our project manager and on-the-ground guy. And so there should have been a handout in your packets. This is the handout that we'll be speaking off of this afternoon. Again, we appreciate a little opportunity to come out here and talk about some of the capital improvement projects that we've been working on. Maybe just to begin, we'll provide a little bit of history on our area. The Cedar River Watershed community in Maurer County is one of those few counties in the state that don't have a lake, right? But we have a number of waterways and streams that make up our area, and that's been the valued piece of our community, is this network of streams. As you can imagine, when you have a vast amount of streams, that also comes with some challenges when those streams get angry, right? So when we've got a number of storm events that come through and at a higher frequency, we've got challenges with our waterways. And from what we've experienced locally, six of the 10 biggest floods that we've experienced in our area have come in the last 25 years. And so flooding is a significant issue in our area. It impacts our infrastructure, our roads, and our bridges. 2004 was our flood of record. When that flood event occurred, we had a loss of life within the city of Austin, which has taken steps to do flood damage protection through flood walls within the community. They've been very successful working with the legislature on projects to put walls that protect that infrastructure. And so hopefully we can reduce the risk of loss of life through those protection measures and loss of property. What those measures have not addressed yet is the upstream issues and where the water is coming from. So out of that same flood event, we had an individual that was driving along the road, and the road gave way and washed out, and we had a loss of life. And this is very common in occurrence that happens in our watershed. We have township roads that go underwater and county roads that go underwater. You can see on the cover sheet we have Interstate 90 that goes over on a regular basis. And so we need to be diligent in our activity of addressing those water resource issues. And so when the Watershed District was formed in 2007, that was in response to all these chronic flood issues. And the community rose up and said, we need to become serious about how we address those flood issues, and we need a dedicated organization to work on that. And so we worked very early on to identify strategies and locations where we could do some modeling and evaluation of where the best place for those projects might be. And so the early years we were developing the information, and we developed a very aggressive capital improvement plan that was had several million dollars attached to it and 25 projects. And at the time that was a significant plan to have together, but it was very important if we were going to actually be serious about our flow reduction goals. In the meantime, 2015, the Hormel Foundation, which is not a Hormel company directly, but it is the philanthropic family foundation that was developed, they were looking to invest into the community on community improvement projects. And so they spent a great deal of time engaging homeowners and people in the community along with some surveys and asking folks, what do you care about the most and what things should we be focusing? If we're going to use this foundation funding, what would you like us to be focused on? And what we found out of that was that the Cedar River ranked very high on that list, and when we were a priority for the community. And so that was a reflection of these years of fear dealing with flooding events, but also the resource itself. We don't have a lake, right? These streams and rivers are Lake Minnetonka, I guess, or Mille Lacs Lake, or whatever, however you want to look at it. They are our resource, and so protecting ourselves and improving the resources is a significant aspect of the community. And so the Hormel Foundation said, well, you guys have this really aggressive capital improvement plan. What if we dedicated $3 million towards that plan with the idea that you'd go out and work with outside resources, if available, to help us implement this plan? And so we did that. We worked with Representative Poppy and Senator Sparks and the legislature and DNR folks on some flood mitigation grants, and we were able to jumpstart our project over the last couple of years, actually. And so phase one is beginning to wrap up of those projects, and I'm going to let Cody talk a little bit about some of those projects in just a moment. But the reason we're here today is to talk a little bit about how important it is to have this momentum going. We're doing some very significant things for infrastructure and for our water quality. And so we want to make sure that we keep that momentum going. So as we wrap up phase one, we want to be rolling right into phase two. And we understand that there may not be a bonding bill this year and these funds are tied to bonding, but it's also very important to keep the discussion going and to be working with all of our partners so that we can keep things going in the right direction, and also show success and progress with our partners at home. The Hormel Foundation has been a great partner, and so keeping that momentum going also puts us in a good position to keep that partnership going as well. So I think with that, Cody, would you like to just talk a little bit with the group about some of our project specific?
If you can go ahead and identify yourself for the record and start your presentation, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Cody Fox, Cedar River Watershed District Project Manager. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, our specific projects. Generally, we're talking earthen embankments here. As Justin mentioned, we have 25 projects as part of our CAP. Currently, we have 9 of those completed. 2019, we're projected to have 7 more projects completed, which we're looking at $2.5 million. Currently, we've requested $700,000 of the $1.7 million that we have, And with that, 2019, we are expecting that we're going to use the remaining money that we have currently. And part of the reason we're here is obviously to start looking at how do we keep this momentum going, like Justin alluded to. We're getting a lot of success. Landowners are coming to us and wanting to do these projects now, which is quite interesting. You know, we're doing these on a voluntary status where we are going to landowners, and not every single project works out. But we've had great success. We're working with producers in the agricultural area. In some cases, some land goes out of production. In some cases, we work directly with the landowner to keep things in production. It's great because it's a great partnership where not only the projects work for us, they also work for them. And we're starting to prove that, and people are starting to see that, and that is why we're starting to have more and more producers come to us in specific areas. And, you know, we have our projects targeted, as Justin alluded to earlier, and on the back of the sheet, too, we kind of talk about some of our targeting measures. These projects, we're estimating through the modeling and stuff that we're going to get at least 10% flow reduction. Very significant. A lot of these projects are also going to have very significant improvements on some of the roads that are directly downstream. As Justin mentioned, many, many township roads overtop, and almost on a yearly basis. These one-year events really aren't the common anymore. It's the 10-year, 25-year events, which are 4 or 5-plus-inch rains very quickly. And so these projects are almost always, as you see if you turn to the second page, the flow reduction is almost over 80% on almost every single project. So they're doing exactly what we want, and we're just trying to build on that momentum.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Anything else that you folks would like to present at this point in time?
I think I'll just maybe wrap up by saying...
Yes, Mr. Anson, go ahead.
Oh, excuse me, sir, Mr. Chair.
No, go ahead.
Maybe just to wrap up, you know, we're very proud of the way that we've gone about this process. We aren't doing any eminent domain projects. This is all based on volunteer approach, working alongside our landowners, and we've had... a great deal of success engaging with them and having them come along with us. I think you'll see that it shows to us. This is a great sign when you look at that back sheet and you see all the dots on the map. Those are all landowners that have said, "Use my land to help do kind of a greater good here, and let's clean up the water with these clean water projects. But then let's also do." Significant things for our roads and infrastructure by implementing these practices. And so we're very proud of the work. We're excited about the work. We're excited about what this means for the community. We're here on behalf of them, and so we look forward to working with the legislature on this as well.
Sounds great. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. I'll open up for questions. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
I appreciate you all coming in, and Representative Poppy, I appreciate your helping out your constituents. I am kind of at a little bit of a loss as I'm looking at the presentation. I see you're asking for $2.3 million. I got that part. What are you actually doing with the money?
As far as project, what
is projects? Mr. Anson, go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So the projects are our detention short duration storage projects. So if you can imagine something that looks a little bit like the picture on the side over here where we're trying to impound some water. In this case, this is a longer duration project where it impounds the water for an extended period of time. On a lot of the projects that Cody's working on, because it is an ag area, and because we're working alongside landowners, we need their participation. We're focused on taking the peak flows off of smaller watersheds and holding the water on the land for shorter periods of time, so to let the water flow through the system and release it gradually. So maybe another way of explaining it, if you go to the second page, we have a couple little graphics towards the bottom. Right here. Essentially, what we're trying to do is implement practices in the watershed that take that peak off, so that this peak that moves through the watershed comes through on a in a big wave. So it, the way that I always think about it is with my little niece. We used to go to Wisconsin Dells, and her favorite thing was going to the wave pool, right? And her idea of fun was to walk out into the wave pool just enough so that the waves would knock you back on your butt, right? And that was fun for her because of the energy of the waves. And our infrastructure is getting knocked on its butt a little bit because we have these waves that come through our system. And so what we're trying to do is take that energy out of the wave that's coming through the watershed. So if you look at the second graphic, you see a less significant peak on that wave. And by implementing a series of detention and storage areas on the landscape, we can reduce that peak and flatten that out and take some of the energy out that's coming through the watershed.
Representative Heinzman.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Go ahead.
So I was a former watershed district manager. So when I asked Ms. Verse, like, what are you going to do with the money, are we talking about specific projects? I'm not seeing, like, locations where each of these projects are. I'm not seeing really a description of what each of that project list would entail. I mean, I get the platitudes. I understand that the high points we're touching here, and maybe we don't have time to go through everything. That's okay, Mr. Chair. I just would like to kind of have a better idea when we're requesting $2.3 million. You know, some of the projects I've been a part of, I could kind of walk people through the detail as to what each of those things might cost and where they were going to be implemented, what the project looked like. So that's what I'm referring to, is that we just have an idea what we would like to be doing with the money, and we have an area where we could do some work, or are these projects already in the works and they actually have to have the funds to move forward, and this is just making sure, okay, here's my specific list. If there is a specific list, where is it?
Sure.
Mr. Hansen, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for those comments, and that's something, is if we can follow up with the committee on that information, we do have a detailed list of projects that we can share for today's purposes, and maybe that's an oversight on my behalf. We were staying high level with our presentation, but that is something that we can put together. Cody can get a list of projects with detailed information on each of those locations. We do list the individual projects here, but we can get into more detail. That's something we can pass along if the committee would see that as being valuable.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. That would be helpful. And one of the things I want to make sure I understand is, if I'm taking a look on the packet that you presented us here under Phase 2, it looks like there's a number of these projects. When I see the year 2020, would those be the projects that this 2.3 would be funding, or would it also be doing some of the 2019 projects that are there?
No.
Go ahead, Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. We do have the funding in place for Phase 1, so we can complete the work that we need to do in Phase 1. It would be the Phase 2 projects that we're targeting for the additional funding.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Any further questions, Representative Hansen?
No, I just appreciate the opportunity to ask the questions. You know, I'm looking at the same thing you are here, Mr. Chair, and I'm seeing $4.7 million appropriation request. I'm seeing a $9 million total cost, and few of those kind of things, and it doesn't match up with the request. So I'm trying to better understand, well, what exactly are we funding, or what are they asking us to fund?
Mm-hmm. No, thank you. Other questions that anyone may have? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Poppy, any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for those questions. I know that they do have details, and they can provide those, and sometimes not everyone is as interested as in the details, but I appreciate that you are, because these guys do their work very well, and they do it very completely, and we have been fortunate in my area to be able to be the recipient of dollars from DNR and from the legislature when it comes to flooding and flood mitigation, and being able to try to do things on the land as well as remove homes and other things throughout the city of Austin. This is an opportunity to kind of go further out than just staying within the bounds of the city limits. So we are able to go out and be able to work with farmers, landowners, to be able to slow the flow, make sure that we are, you know, water is going to come. So we have to try to figure out how do we use it and how do we manage it, and that's really what they've been doing, and it's been very successful. We continue to be the recipient of that success within the city of Austin, because that's where these waters flow to, and so I appreciate that they are diligent in their work, and I know they're able to provide more detail, and I appreciate that that's an opportunity that has come out of this, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Poppe. The chair renews their motion that House File 408 be re-referred to the Environment Finance Committee Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Poppe, and good luck with your next stop.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Our next bill is we're going to hold off for a moment on, so what I would like to do is to have Mr. Keene come down and start his presentation on the overview of drainage law. So if we could get underway with that, and then when Representative Hansen comes in, we'll take a pause and deal with his bill when he arrives. Mr. Keene, welcome to the committee today. Thank you for coming in to make your presentation. If you'd like to go ahead and start, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Again, as the chairman indicated, my name is Al Kane. I serve as the chief engineer for the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I also serve as the coordinator for the Stakeholder Drainage Work Group. So I thought I would give you an overview of drainage in Minnesota, including drainage law, not trying to get too deep into drainage law, but certainly be open to any questions that you may have about that as we go along. Just at the beginning here slide, I wanted to just point out that drainage is both an agricultural and urban issue, and I included a winter shot here because we've been living with it for the last week or so, and certainly from an agricultural perspective, nutrient transport is part of the issues. And for an urban one, as we maybe experience in the wintertime, salt is one of our concerns that we have as well. So we have a lot of things that we want to consider whenever we're dealing with drainage, both from an agricultural and urban standpoint. So why do we drain? Again, it's not something that is brand new to us. It's been done forever, if you will. It's a question of how we do it. And certainly within Minnesota, in our agricultural area, agricultural land use and productivity is a big reason why we do ag drainage, but we also drain for our roads, trying to keep them in good shape and enable good commerce. Maybe not as much at current times, but if we go back in time, insect and disease control was a significant issue. In the settlements of the Midwest, malaria actually was a significant concern, and it was one of the reasons why the states and the landowners did drainage. I mentioned urban land uses, and you've been hearing from Cedar River Watershed District, who I work with significantly too, about flood control. So those are all reasons that we do drainage and drainage management, if you will. This map is one from the Agricultural Research Service, about 2010 year. And the colors indicate just the percentage of the land based upon soil types for which agricultural drainage can make a significant difference in terms of land use and productivity. One thing that you might notice there from southern Minnesota down into Iowa, that's the Des Moines Lobe you hear about, which is part of the last glaciation of Minnesota and Iowa. And it's an area where agricultural drainage is quite prevalent. You'll see other areas in the Red River Basin of Minnesota. And note then, too, like over in Ohio, the northwest corner, that's a glacial lake bed, too. And therefore, agricultural drainage is a major issue there as well. But throughout the upper Midwest, ag drainage is one of the keys to productivity for much of our land. This is a map from the USDA, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, just showing where we have drainage prevalence, if you will, across the United States. And the upper Midwest, as you can see again, is fairly prevalent. So Minnesota Drainage Law, one of the things that's interesting to note is that the first Drainage Act passed by the Minnesota legislature was the first year that we became a state, in 1858. And within your packet, you should have a chronology that I actually put this together between Christmas and New Year's, just looking back at drainage law in Minnesota, trying to get a sense of how has it evolved over time from 1858 to present. What I did was just do a listing of all of the statute numbers, titles, and the major headings within those. So you can see that it has changed from being first in the lands chapter of statute, and then it moved into drains and drainage, and in the years more recent in the 20th century, there was a lot more prevalence about looking at county and judicial and townships and how drainage law applied to them. And then in 1955-ish, whenever Minnesota adopted the watershed district law, which is now currently chapter 103D, that's when we had a change too in who could become a drainage authority. So watershed districts became part of that. We think about, again, from the beginning, what were the key purposes of drainage law? It was to facilitate ag production via drainage across landowner boundaries and government jurisdictional boundaries. So in the first Drainage Act, they actually enabled landowners to come together as corporations to do a drainage project. And then later, who became the drainage authority has evolved over time. But again, ag production was one of the keys in the beginning, facilitating transportation and commerce. Roads that didn't flood was an important aspect of what they were trying to achieve. And I mentioned then again, reducing stagnant water, insects and disease. So public health has been part of the reason why Minnesota has had drainage law from the beginning. Current drainage law is in Minnesota Statutes, Chapter 103E, Drainage. It's been 103E since the recodification of water law in 1990. One of the things that about Chapter 103E that I'd like to point out to people is that we talk about these as public drainage systems, and they're really more accurately called publicly administered drainage systems, because the landowners who pay for their establishment and maintenance are actually co-owners of those systems. So our drainage authorities are administering drainage law on behalf of those landowners. So they are managing those systems across multiple landowners and jurisdictions, if you will. The benefit property owners I mentioned are co-owners. They pay for the systems. And it's important to understand, too, that Chapter 103E systems are both open ditches and subsurface tile. So particularly in the southern part of the state, many of the Chapter 103E systems are actually tile systems, or they may be a combination of tile and open ditch. The Minnesota Buffer Law 2015 created the need to develop the buffer protection map that DNR developed. A component of that is the Chapter 103E drainage systems, ditches, not all of the tile, but the ditches. And so this is a map of where all of the Chapter 103E drainage ditches are in the state. Again, you can see that corresponds to some of the previous maps that I showed in regard to where drainage can do substantial good, if you will, for agricultural production. So there's 19,150 miles of Chapter 103E ditch. We don't know exactly how many miles of tile. We haven't had a reason to accumulate all of that, but there's substantial miles of Chapter 103E subsurface tile systems as well. And note that this map does not include private agricultural drainage tile systems, which we'll talk about a bit more down the line. I mentioned that over the years, the decades, there's been various drainage authorities that implemented Minnesota drainage law. Townships were a drainage authority way back when. There are a few ditches out there that are called town ditch number something whenever townships were drainage authorities. Counties have been a drainage authority pretty much for the entire time that Minnesota has had drainage law. At one time, there was an 8-county commission up in the Red River Basin that was a drainage authority on behalf of landowners. The state of Minnesota had a drainage commission that was a drainage authority for drainage law in the past. And so were district courts. And it's actually up until the 1970s that district courts could be a drainage authority. Those systems have since been turned over to what are now county, joint county, and watershed district boards, who are our current Chapter 103 drainage authorities. Those folks, as I mentioned, those local governments, they administer these public drainage systems in accordance with Chapter 103 and other applicable law. There are provisions in other law that can still apply to drainage systems, including public waters law of the state. Federal Clean Water Act provisions can apply, and the Wetland Conservation Act can apply to certain situations as well. Therefore, if we think about, again, who's been a drainage authority, drainage system identifiers, we have county ditches, which actually can be a county ditch, open ditch, or a tile. We have state ditches. We have judicial ditches, watershed district ditches. And then within those systems, you'll hear the terminology of a main, a lateral, a branch, a spur. There's different terminology for the different fingers, if you will, of drainage systems on the land. So our current drainage authorities, 76 of 87 counties in Minnesota, do have some Chapter 103 drainage system. It can vary from a few miles to many hundreds of miles within a county or a watershed district. 21 of 45 watershed districts are drainage authorities. And we should be aware, too, that within watershed district law, there is a provision that if landowners want to petition for an establishment or an improvement of a drainage system where there is a watershed district, then that triggers the transfer of drainage authority from the county or joint county to a watershed district. So that's been part of the way things have transitioned over time since we've had watershed district law.
Mr. Kane? I'm going to have you pause just a moment there. I see Representative Hansen has come in the room, so what I'd like to do is put this on pause. Absolutely. For a moment, and then I can have Representative Hansen and his testifiers come down, and we can deal with this bill, and then we can move back to your presentation here. So with that, thank you, committee, for patience. I'd like to welcome Representative Hansen to the committee today. We have House File 582 up for consideration. I move that it be referred to the division by the Environmental Finance Division. And Representative Hansen, would you please present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hate to interrupt the drainage presentation, but I think Mr. Kane will be able to follow up quickly. Inflow infiltration is an issue that some of you have heard from before. House File 582 is a bonding bill where we would consider the capital investment in the public infrastructure for inflow and infiltration. And I have with me today, from a broad perspective, the Met Council talking about inflow infiltration, and then also a specific city's example of the costs of inflow infiltration. The legislature has invested in solving inflow infiltration problems for both the public infrastructure, which would be general obligation bonds, but also for the private infrastructure using clean water funds. The bill today in front of us is for the public infrastructure with general obligation bonds. Okay. So with that, I have with me Ms. Nauman.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Next, I would like to have Ms. Nauman introduce herself and start her testimony, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I also have just a brief handout for you as well, if I could get a page there's a page handy or not. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, representing cities throughout the seven-county metropolitan area at both the legislature, executive branch, and Metropolitan Council. Metro Cities does support House File 582, authored by Representative Hansen, and we appreciate his authorship and sponsorship of this legislation. It is intended to provide a $10 million capital appropriation that would be used as grants that would be distributed to cities, qualifying cities in the metropolitan area, specifically those cities that are experiencing significant issues with excess inflow and infiltration. Those cities that are experiencing excess levels of inflow and infiltration are identified by the Metropolitan Council, because the council does have responsibility for the regional wastewater system, and that's where INI can have implications when clean water ends up inadvertently, because of compromised infrastructure largely, ends up flowing into the regional wastewater system and ends up being treated unnecessarily. That capacity is intended to be used for treatment of wastewater and not clean water, and it ends up using capacity that then is not available for the wastewater treatment. The cities that cities in the metropolitan area are uniquely, I would say, compelled by the Metropolitan Council to address their issues with local INI. Back in 2004, there was a task force of city officials that worked with the Metropolitan Council on this issue and basically how to address it, and there was widespread agreement that this is an issue with significant implications for the regional system, and that it is most effectively and actually cost-efficiently addressed at the local level. The Metropolitan Council has estimated that if it's not fixed at the local level, additional wastewater capacity would need to be built, and that costs upwards of about $1 billion, as opposed to treating it at the local level, which is still expensive but far less expensive than actually having to build more regional capacity. This is basic infrastructure that, as cities have gone along and tried to address issues of INI, it gets more expensive, it gets more difficult to try to treat the issues, and so we believe that this is a hopefully fairly modest request in a bonding bill that would actually be able to help many cities in the metro area with these issues. The City of West St. Paul Public Works Director Ross Beckwith is also here today, and he can give you an example of how that city is trying to address their INI. But I appreciate your time today, Mr. Chair and members, and would be happy to answer any questions about our support for this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Are there any questions for Ms. Nauman? Hearing none, why don't we bring down our next testifier, Mr. Beckwith. Please introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ross Beckwith, I am Public Works, Parks Director, and City Engineer for the City of West St. Paul. City of West St. Paul, population 20,000 people, about 5 miles square city. West St. Paul has been an early and often offender of INI, and since 2008, a program has been started there where kind of a two-pronged approach. Obviously, there's issues with city infrastructure, so our sanitary sewers and manholes, money's being spent on an annual basis to line them, put in INI barriers in our castings to keep the water out, and then again the residents as well. So we started the program in 2008, basically going door to door, which was not overly popular, asking people or basically telling people we need to come and inspect your sewer lateral, look for cracks, leaks, breaks, places where water's getting in. Kind of the era that a lot of the homes were built in West St. Paul also, they used to connect roof leads or foundation drains to the sanitary sewer. So you can imagine every time it rained, all that water from the roof instantly entering the sanitary sewer main line and overwhelming the system. We've had multiple backups in our city where of flooding and, you know, backups of sewer into people's houses because of INI. So over the past 11 years, we have spent about $8 million in the city, almost half, almost 50-50, half the residents have paid for fixing laterals, and average lateral cost is around $5,500 for property owners. And again, the city has put in the other approximately $4 million as well. So it's something we do every year. So about 2 years ago, actually, we changed our program from going door-to-door to a point-of-sale program. So now at the time when you sell your house in West St. Paul, you're required to get an inspection of your sanitary sewer lateral. If there are issues that need to be fixed, that is part of the negotiation of selling your house, kind of help out with the high cost of this problem for homeowners. So again, it's a big problem for us. We just topped 50% of the houses that have been inspected in West St. Paul. Around 2,700 have been done in the last 11 years. So we're marching our way through. And again, same thing with our sewer mains through the city. It's televising, hitting the worst ones every year. We have a small pot of money we use to combat it, but you know, I guess as a point of reference too, the entire operating budget for the city of West St. Paul for 2019 is $14 million, and the last 11 years we've spent $4 million of city funds towards that. So it's a big deal. We want to fix it. We did appreciate bills like this to try and help us out.
Thank you, Mr. Beckwith. Are there any questions for Mr. Beckwith? I have a quick one, and I may have missed a little bit. What percentage of your sewer lines have you been able to get through, and what percentage would you say are left? And then also, what is the average age of your sewer line, Mr. Beckwith?
Well, okay, so West St. Paul, if you go from north to south, we have sewer that's 100 years old on the north end there where we abut St. Paul. We have brick manholes, black manholes. And then you get further south, and you've got a lot newer infrastructure. Some of it's maybe 20 years old. So there's a big gradient of issues in the city. Percentage-wise of sewer mainline that we've gone through and lined is probably 15%, I would say. And again, with houses, the laterals are at 50% inspected. So,
thank you, Mr. Beckwith. And I would imagine that programs like this allows you to get to the problem a lot quicker and solve it versus otherwise it would take much longer for you to get the job done then. Correct, Mr. Beckwith?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay, super. Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, I think if it's not clear, this is something that residents must do. It is not a voluntary best management practice. It is something they must do. So prior to the inspection of going door to door, that would be an ordinance where people had to allow that inspection, and then they would be assessed for that cost of fixing it. Now, and I've already been having constituents who are transferring property, very old homes where they're moving into assisted living or whatever, and then the heirs are having to deal with a very high cost. We're talking $8,000 to $10,000 maybe, depending on the age. Could be 5, 6, 7, but this is not and I think historically the legislature has provided maybe $1 or $2, perhaps $3 million of assistance on the public infrastructure over the years. But again, there's no voluntary best management practices. The cost share has been very limited for the individual homeowners. They have no way to recover that on many of these homes. As the sale, all this occurred at the same time that the economy crashed in 08. And so it's a number of houses that we're dealing with a very expensive problem. So I would ask that you consider this seriously and that we can do something to help out cities. And just to be clear, the city of West St. Paul is not the west side of St. Paul. It is a separate freestanding city, and it's separate from South St. Paul and North St. Paul. There are a number of communities throughout the metropolitan area that have their own government and their own surprising costs that occur that they have to meet.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Are there questions? Representative Haley, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Hansen. I don't know if you can answer this or perhaps the chair can. I'm curious that the it's significant money that has been spent over the years, and it sounds like significant money that's going to be needed into the future to address the problem. I'm curious if rural cities face these same issues, and how do we address their funding needs then as well?
I've got some of that information, but I was wondering if the author had any thoughts on that before I
Mr. Chair and Representative Haley, there are a number of rural cities that have the flow, inflow infiltration problem. The difference is that the Met Council provides a penalty to the services within the metro area for that loss. So the loss that is there for rural communities is that loss in their water, but because of the loss for water, and Mr. Beckwith could explain how that charge, there's an actual charge put on the cities to fix this, as well as the charge put on the homeowners and the city to pay for the infrastructure. There's a penalty that's there for any community within that Met Council jurisdiction that has an inflow problem.
Mr. Beckwith?
So after rain events is the easiest time to monitor that. So there's three monitors that leave the city of West St. Paul that each are reflect a different portion of the city. So in a large rain event, all of a sudden these monitors are spiking, and they'll Met Council uses that data basically to say, yep, you have added this much extra flow to our system, overwhelming our system, therefore you now have a surcharge of $2.5 million. So the city of West St. Paul says, okay, we have a $2.5 million problem here. What's another way to work on this? Say, well, you can use that, you can take that number basically and set up a program to mitigate and fix your system. So invest in your city. And we've worked closely with Met Council and revised this numerous times over the years on what that program looks like, how aggressive we are. And we are definitely putting in the program as it stays. You have to put more money in than that 2.5 over so many years to basically wipe the penalty out. So obviously we need to invest in our infrastructure. It makes more sense than to pay a fine than to fix our sewers. So
thank you.
Representative Haley, any other follow up questions?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. One of the things that I know from over the history as this has been worked with in the Met Council area is I know that one point in time a lot of the storm sewers used to feed into Met Council, into their sewer system, and those have been separated out. And I know that it was not unusual in past that when there were heavy storm events that it would lead to raw sewage discharge by the Met Council sewage treatment plant directly to the Mississippi River. And so this has been part of a larger effort that they've taken over a number of years to make sure they get at that, to make sure that not only is all the sewage just sewage coming in, but also making sure that they limit the problems that could be caused by inflow infiltration, storm events that would cause raw sewage being released into the Mississippi. Any further questions? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Hearing none, the chair renews the motion that House File 582 be re-referred to the Environment Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Hansen. I hope you get good treatment at your next committee, sir. And then if we could have Mr. Kane come back down, we can continue with drainage law. And Mr. Caden, before you get started, there, I'd like to back up to slide number five, as I had a couple of questions as you were talking about drainage law. And what I was trying to do is get a little understanding is because, you're hitting very much in the agriculture area. I know that in the metropolitan area, a lot of the storm systems that we have now funnel into old ditch systems or used part of the old ditch system. So when you're mentioning before about the public drainage system in the agriculture areas, how does that match with in the urban areas, or are they more covered by the stormwater, the MPCA? Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chairman, members, correct that probably the best way to think about this is that as the urban areas grew and overtake the agricultural areas, the Chapter 103E drainage systems, which were primarily put in for agriculture, and to which municipalities can also connect to, they're used as an outlet for outstate municipalities and within the metro as well. But there is a provision that was added to drainage law, and I can't recall exactly the year, but the early 2000s, for transfer of drainage systems from a Chapter 103E drainage authority, county, joint county, or watershed district, to another water management organization, which can be in a municipality. So there is a provision to enable a 103E system to become a municipal stormwater system. If that occurs, then anyone upstream on the system needs to be guaranteed that they still have an outlet too. So the provisions of the law are that there can be a transfer, that it may make good sense for a municipality to manage that system as part of their stormwater infrastructure, but then they also have to provide for an outlet for the remainder of the agricultural or Chapter 103E system that had existed as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kane. And then another question I had was kind of where you hit slide number six. One of the things I was kind of interested in, it built off a little bit from your slide five, was that you had mentioned that it's not only open ditches but subsurface tile mains. So does that mean part of the county ditch system is subsurface, or are the subsurface just the private ones? Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chairman, in fact, part of the Chapter 103E public system is tile. So there are many systems that are a combination of tile and open ditch, or there can be systems that are nothing but subsurface tile. So typically those systems would be mains and laterals into some of the lowest areas, if you will. The private tile is separate. So, and you'll hear me talk about this a little bit too, that under private drainage, if I'm a benefited landowner in a system, so I'm a co-owner of that public drainage system, I have a right to outlet my private drainage into it. If I'm not part of the benefited area, then I need to petition into that system, petition for an outlet into that system. So there's a provision for both private landowners and municipalities, for example, to petition the drainage system and drainage authority for an outlet into that system with other private or municipal drainage systems. Make sense?
That helps. Thank you, Mr. Kane.
You're welcome.
Why don't you go ahead and pick up from your presentation for where you left off then.
So I left off here just talking about, well, who are our drainage authorities under Chapter 103? And again, it's the Blue Counties, 76 of 87. And 21 of 45 watershed districts, they're the ones that are hashed, if you will. And there's a number of counties that have transferred all of their Chapter 103 systems to a watershed district, some in the metro area and some outstate, so that the county is no longer a drainage authority. The watershed district or watershed districts within their boundaries have become the drainage authority for all of their Chapter 103E systems. So we know that Minnesota drainage law goes way back to the beginning of the state. The first time there was a manual put together about drainage law was 1991. The DNR had actually received a Clean Water Act Section 319 grant to develop this. They had multiple committees and stakeholder organizations who were part of that. So that the original Minnesota Public Drainage Manual, 1991, was hard copy, three-ring binder. It was kind of the major reference document for many drainage authorities and others involved in it. And then in 2016, Bowser had been given in the previous couple of years funding to update the Minnesota Public Drainage Manual. We worked with the Stakeholder Drainage Work Group and other stakeholders to have advisory committees and developed then a new version, which is in a wiki format, electronic, with the idea that it would be much easier to maintain it then over time and also much more easy to access it on any platform, if you will, be it computer or cell phone or however. We can access this wiki document that way. So that was a major effort to update the public drainage manual. And just as another point of reference, between 1991 and 2016, there were 33 sections of 106 sections in drainage law that were modified or added. And some of those were ones, 20-some of those were ones that the Stakeholder Drainage Work Group had made recommendations to revise, to update. So that has all been incorporated into this new version of the manual, those changes in drainage law since 1991. And the Board of Water and Soil Resources has a plan, a method for how to maintain the public drainage manual over time. And part of that relates to the Stakeholder Drainage Work Group. You've maybe heard this work group being talked about in the past. It's been around since 2006. It was an outgrowth of a legislative directive for Bowser to do a public drainage ditch buffer study. The reason for that was that in 1977, drainage law was modified to require one rod, 16.5-foot buffer strips along public drainage ditches whenever viewers are appointed. Viewers are the folks who determine benefits and damages for public drainage systems. And so we believe that the reason that the legislature tied it to that is because in order to define the value of the land rights that were acquired for the buffer strips, you need someone to define what that value was, and viewers are the folks who do that. So an outgrowth of that study was this Stakeholder Drainage Work Group. A number of stakeholders had been together then for about a year and decided that, you know, we ought to stick together and maybe make some recommendations on things in drainage law that could use some updating and improvement. So the work group has put forth seven sets of recommendations to date. Five of those have been adopted into drainage law since 2007. And we have two in process, and there are bills that will be introduced this year to carry those. I'll just mention again that the work group, it is a broad stakeholder group. You can see the lists there of all the different organizations who participate to varying degrees, because not every meeting does everyone attend, but typically at drainage work group meetings we have 30 to 35 people, sometimes up to 45, and these are all folks who have an interest in drainage. The work group is science-based, trying to look at finding mutual understandings that is science-based. Focuses on updates of Chapter 103 drainage law and other related provisions. And we have also responded to a number of directives from the legislature to do a study or report as well. And of the sets of recommendations that are coming forth this session, one of those is because of legislative directive to evaluate and make recommendations to accelerate drainage system acquisition of buffer strips that have been required by the buffer law. Bowser coordinates the drainage work group in accordance with Section 103B 101, Subdivision 13. That provision was added in 2010 at the recommendation of the drainage work group. Another document that is very useful for reference, it's sometimes referred to as the Cliff Notes version of drainage law. It's this document called Understanding Minnesota Public Drainage Law. It was originally commissioned by the Association of Minnesota Counties in coordination with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, last updated in 2002. We're currently working on an update of that document as another good, I'll call it ready reference, about Minnesota drainage law. We talked a little bit about private tile a bit earlier. Chairman Fisher had asked a question about private tile versus the public drainage systems. And again, I mentioned earlier that landowners who help pay for a Chapter 103E system have a right to outlet into it. And anyone else that's in the watershed who wants to outlet into that needs to petition for an outlet into that and pay an outlet fee. Or if there's a redetermination of benefits and damages done, then they may become part of the benefited area. There's been a provision in drainage law since 1987 that enables viewers to assign per acre benefits for an outlet into a drainage system as well. So when redeterminations of benefits and damages are done, many times that enlarges the benefited area quite substantially. We know that private pattern tile has been done in the state for many decades. In recent times, it's been put in more frequently, partly because of the technology and the materials. Tile was originally all vitrified clay tile, and then it went to concrete tile, and now it's plastic. So you'll see the rolls of plastic tile that can be either dug in if it's big enough that you need to dig a trench, or it can be plowed in. So there's machinery that can carve, if you will, a path and lay the tile right behind it of that plastic tile. And as you may well be aware too, most of our construction equipment today is controlled with global positioning systems, and therefore it can all be electronic and lay it on exactly the grade and depth that it's designed at. So the increased production from agricultural tile typically has payback in years, sometimes maybe in decades, depends upon the value of commodity crops. But for corn and beans, no doubt that agricultural tile has been a significant part of the way that landowners have increased their productivity. Some watershed districts and water management organizations have rules that therefore require permits for private drainage, which includes agricultural drainage. In the Red River Basin, historically, there hadn't been a lot of tile drainage until more recent times. And now it's coming in substantially. A lot of that tile is pumped tile systems. They lay a pattern tile, the outlet into a ditch is higher than the elevation of the tile because they need to put the tile in the ground at least 3 feet so that you don't break it, if you will, or crush it when you're doing farming operations. And in order to outlet it, then it needs a pump at the end of the system. So on the order of 3/4 of the new tile drainage systems in the Red River Basin are pumped. In southern Minnesota, there's quite a few that are pumped as well. But they're pumped out into then typically a drainage ditch, which may be a Chapter 103E drainage ditch. One of the things that that enables is what we call today controlled subsurface drainage. You only drain when you need it. You don't drain when you don't need it, if you will. So landowners can pump those systems when they need extra drainage, don't when they don't. And in fact, there are watershed districts who control when they allow the landowners to pump those systems. They won't allow them to pump them during a flooding condition. So an example is on the Bois de Sioux Watershed District website. If you go on there, you can see a green light or a red light. Green light means the landowners can turn on their pumps. Red light means they have to turn them off. So that's the way that they manage their overall water systems. One of the things that I've been a proponent, Bowser's been a proponent of for a long time, is multi-purpose drainage management. Trying to manage our drainage in a way that achieves multiple purposes, and it's something that we're all trying to work towards. You have in your packet a handout about multi-purpose drainage management, which is trying to be just a very brief overview of what is it, how can you do it, what kind of practices might it involve. This is not a complete list, but it gives some ideas of some of the practices on agricultural land that can be part of multi-purpose drainage management to achieve erosion reduction, agricultural drainage for productivity, which is the number one reason that ag drainage is put in place, how to have better manage water quality, flood control, and habitat. One thing that I'll mention, too, that the Drainage Work Group has done over the years is made recommendations to enable two-stage ditches to be part of a petition repair. And where that makes a lot of sense is where we have channelized streams, where we have flow, perennial flow in a stream. Mother Nature's going to tend to want a low-flow channel within a larger one, so a two-stage ditch enables the official cross-section of a Chapter 103E system to be something that's more compatible with what Mother Nature would like to see and will remain stable. So it protects the aquatic habitat in the low-flow channel, and it still provides adequate capacity for drainage. Storage is something that you probably hear about more, too, and altered hydrology. How do we mitigate, if you will, some of the altered hydrology that drainage has caused? And clearly storage is one of the ways that we do that. It can be done at many different scales, from the ag field per scale to the farm scale and to subwatersheds and watershed scale. So just trying to let folks know that there are provisions in drainage law that enable multi-purpose drainage management. They're ones that the drainage authority and the landowners need to choose to use. They aren't required, other than they have to look for, whenever they do a drainage project, they have to investigate the availability of outside sources of funding. So programs, both federal and state, that maybe can help work together with the drainage system to do multi-purpose drainage management. I'll close with a slide about where we are in time that I think is really important part of overall state of Minnesota water management. And that's one watershed, one plan. As you know, we've adopted watershed-based water planning to try to consolidate water planning, to try to make it more efficient, effective, if you will, on a watershed scale. And one of the things that the Drainage Work Group has done to help make drainage law more compatible with that is proposing recommendations for revising Section 103E015, considerations before drainage work is done. That provision has a number of different multi-purpose, if you will, considerations that drainage authorities must consider when they're doing a drainage project. It also, as I mentioned just a minute ago, it has a provision that was added that whenever a drainage project is done, the drainage authority must investigate external sources of funding that will enable it to potentially do more multi-purpose drainage management. We have to recognize that drainage authorities do have an administrative and fiduciary responsibility to the landowners who own those Chapter 103E systems. They take that seriously as they need to. And local water planning authorities have much more multi-purpose water management purpose in local water planning. And of our local water planning authorities, two of them are also drainage authorities, counties and watershed districts. So what One Watershed, One Plan is promoting is wearing those hats together to the extent they reasonably can be and trying to achieve our water quality and other water quantity and water management objectives together, if we will, the best we can under One Watershed, One Plan implementation. So with that, I would take any other questions you might have. And if you have any about drainage law, don't hesitate, because we'll try to bring everybody up to speed.
Thank you, Mr. Kane. Appreciate the presentation. Does anyone have any particular questions right offhand for Mr. Kane? Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kane, thanks for the presentation. Part of our family farms in western Minnesota, Yellow Medicine County, and I've heard a lot of conversations over the year about tiling and appreciate the importance of drainage on that land and the effect it's had on the family income. At the same time, I'm trying to read and catch up with information about maintaining the pristine nature of fresh water in Minnesota. And that concern is that the runoff of pollutants from farmland is causing harm for our water resources. How do we approach both the benefits of drainage and the benefits of herbicides, I guess, as well as maintaining this important resource of natural water is the multi-purpose drainage management helping that, or what? How do we go forward on this,
Mr. Kane?
Mr. Chairman and members, it's a challenging task. But one of the things that multi-purpose drainage management, if you look at in the lower right, the controlled subsurface drainage, a way to, as I mentioned about pump drainage systems. Those you can control because you control when to turn the pump on and off.
Mm-hmm.
But in a gravity system, you can put in a control structures and drain the water table down for planting in the spring, raise it back up after mm-hmm. you've planted, trying to maintain a higher level of water and therefore less loss of nutrients during the growing season. Drain it back down in the fall for harvest.
Mm.
So that's one way,
yeah.
And it's called drainage water management. That's the terminology that's used. State and federal programs can help cost share for that. Another thing that we've added to this multi-purpose drainage management program at Bowser under the Clean Water Fund is storage and treatment wetland restorations. So a wetland restoration, if one can outlet tile into it, is a great denitrifier. Wetlands denitrify as effectively as most anything we have. Mm. So we added a way for drainage authorities to work with soil and water conservation districts and to implement storage and treatment wetlands. The drainage authority owns an easement on that land, so it becomes part of the system. So they've got an ability then to have some storage both for water quality reasons and for water quantity reasons. As you heard the Cedar River Watershed District talk about storage that dampens the peak flows.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what a storage and treatment wetland restoration can do too. So those are ways that help, but it certainly is a challenge. One of the things that I personally have significant hope for in the future is increasing soil organic matter that enables us to have more water storage in the soil profile, less loss of water to subsurface and surface runoff. So another way to try to keep the water and the nutrients on the field and crop available and not lose them downstream.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Keene. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sandell. Does anyone have any other questions for Mr. Keene today? Hearing none, Mr. Kane, thank you for coming and doing the presentation. This helps give us a little bit of idea about drainage law. I do know that at some point we'll be having a bill coming through that's going to deal with some of these issues. So I wanted to have a little prep course available for us to be ready for it. This is the last item we have on the agenda, so I will remind people that, if I remember right, next week we are not meeting. There is a special day planned, so we will not have our next meeting until 2 weeks from today. We will have a number of bills that will be having to start approach us at that point in time. It is possible as we get toward the end of session and as the logjam of files are breaking loose from the revisor's office, I would anticipate that we may have some nights where we may be meeting later in the evening to make sure that we can get all the bills here that are coming to us. So, Representative Heintzman.
To that. Announcement, are we going to be on the road like some of these other committees? I've heard a number of folks that have a lot of things going on, and as some of those committees have transitioned to other parts of the state, it's become quite a challenge. Is this committee going to be doing that?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Heinzman. At this point in time with the session that we have, I don't see anything happen for the next few weeks on that. I would imagine if we were going to do something like that, that might be something that we would maybe do in the interim or next year.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Heinzman. And with that, we are adjourned.